just understanding. There's a curiosity about who Muslims are, how they worship. The number of times I'm invited to like give a talk about what is the significance of Ramadan, which literally has nothing to do with anything I research or write about or teach about. But I guess as a person who has written about Islamophobia and a Muslim scholar, that's what I'm expected to do, is explain who Muslims are to the West. And rather than explaining who Muslims are to the West, I'd way more explain how Western forces have related to the quote unquote Muslim world in these ways that you're describing, in ways that have targeted and harassed Muslims, but have also provided key material support and even authorship of right-wing Islamism. And Indonesia, I think, is just an object lesson for that. But I also wanted to say, just jumping back to what we were talking about before, you know, this NPR article where they're like, Iraq has these elections now. They don't mention that in 2020, Iraq actually voted to expel U.S. troops. I just think there's this hilarious, it's very transparent, this hilarious colonial kind of approach to thinking about U.S. statecraft in so-called Muslim majority countries that just when you just look a little bit closer, it just falls apart. It's just so, so flimsy.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it is so flimsy when I'm thinking about it. I really appreciate you going in to some of the details about Indonesia as well, because I do think in the popular consciousness in the U.S., it's like, where does Islam live? I mean, it's a very particular mindset of exactly where it lives. It's just on the Arabian Peninsula, and it's just in the desert. And this is just what Muslims are. It's a very particular view and expectation and perspective around what people in the U.S. actually know about Islam. And so I think Indonesia is a very important critical piece of this. And there's so much more to learn also just when you go into kind of the history of struggle in Indonesia that you can pull from the Communist Party in Indonesia, the kind of struggle they waged, and of course, the U.S. opposition to it. But I wanted to pick up this thread here, Nazia, that you had just mentioned. I mean, I'd like to talk about Iraq today. I mean, I think that it's a nice transition point for me when we're talking about the past 20 years. We're talking about so many different elements of this. But one thing that I think people are really not in the know about too much, to be honest, is the current state of Iraq. And where did the U.S. invasion actually leave people? I mean, we're talking about, I would say, cumulatively, like over a million people displaced and or killed. I mean, there really is a complete destruction of the country on so many levels. And I think the American public after the war, there really was a mass drop in interest to talk about, well, you know, I guess Iraq is free now. Let's just move on entirely. And I think that that is absolutely not the situation in case. Iraq has been left significantly worse off after the invasion. And so I'd love for you to talk more about kind of the details of this and what people aren't quite seeing about the kind of what the mess is that the U.S. leaves behind after they've waged these kinds of wars.
For sure. I mean, I think, you know, the toll of U.S. involvement in Iraq is unmeasurable in so many ways. And of course, formal attempts to measure it, whether we're talking about, you know, the death toll, the loss of life, et cetera, are often gross undercounts for a number of reasons. But, you know, shock and awe, the 2003 invasion of Iraq, of course, there was the immediate assault on Iraq, the targeting of civilian infrastructure, which actually predates the 2003 invasion, the targeting of hospitals, of baby formula factories, just has this toll on civilian life in Iraq that is really horrendous. But now we're here, you know, 20 years later, and we see this legacy unfolding. So, of course, with the removal of Saddam Hussein from power, there's what a lot of experts have called this kind of power vacuum, which is that, you know, with Saddam Hussein was keeping in check the forces of Islamist militarism. In spite of the U.S. trying to conflate Saddam Hussein with Al-Qaeda, anyone who knows anything about the region knows that it couldn't be further from the truth. And of course, so with Saddam Hussein and his government taken out of power and the de-Ba'athification that happened under L. Paul Bremer, basically a colonial viceroy of Iraq, what happens is a whole bunch of folks are put into prisons, U.S. military prisons, and years later, we'll see those same people who were incarcerated and tortured and jailed by the U.S. forces forming ISIS. And ISIS is, of course, a direct result of the U.S. shock and awe campaign of the removal of Saddam Hussein from power. And so you see that. And then you also see the result on the Iraqi sort of social welfare state, where basic social services and all of these kinds of things have crumbled. Iraq has been looted by U.S. presence in the region, but also by U.S. alliance with Iraqi elites who have been eager to to loot the coffers of Iraq since then for two decades now.
You're listening to Covert Action Bulletin, the official show and podcast of Covert Action Magazine, where we've been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. We'll be right back with more of our conversation with Dr. Nazia Kazi, the author of Islamophobia, Race, and Global Politics, and an associate professor of anthropology at Stockton University in New Jersey.
I am not afraid. I am not afraid. I will die for liberation, 'cause I know why I was made. I am not afraid. I am not afraid. I will die for liberation, 'cause I know why I was made. I am not
Welcome back to Covert Action Bulletin, the official show and podcast of Covert Action Magazine, where we've been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. We've got more of a conversation right now with Dr. Nazia Kazi, the author of Islamophobia, Race, and Global Politics, and an associate professor of anthropology at Stockton University in New Jersey. You know, the U.S. initially said, oh, we'll be, you know, in and out in a few weeks. You know, Donald Rumsfeld famously, you know, saying this is not going to be a long protracted war. But as soon as it became clear that the Iraqi people were going to be resisting and defending their homeland, the U.S. government within a year or two then said, you know, this could lead to the power vacuum. They knew very clearly that this power vacuum that did occur could exist. And then we also saw under the Obama administration kind of the justification for staying in Iraq to avoid the power vacuum. But also, I remember a lot of building schools and fixing roads and things like that, which, well, why were they destroyed in the first place? Because of the U.S. war. I want to connect this as well, the power vacuum, the rise of ISIS to Syria and the U.S. machinations against Syria, because, you know, the Syrian government, which is, you know, a national bourgeois government, certainly not a progressive, has worked with the U.S. in the past. I mean, the government of Bashar al-Assad allowed the CIA to open up black sites after 9/11, where torture happened. And still, we see, of course, the U.S. government comes in and says, Assad must go. That was the refrain for so long. And, you know, that conflict continues today. But it led to the U.S. funding the so-called moderate rebels, right? They were anything but moderate, of course. But the, you know, the amount of money, political support, and political capital that, you know, went to forces aligned with or directly involved with ISIS or some of these other groups like al-Nusra, you know, shows to me that the U.S. time and time again does not care about the religious ideology of a specific group, but it's a political question. The question is, can we use this group, this person, this ideology to further U.S. interests? And then in 20 years, you know, we can write our retrospectives and our memoirs about how messy it all was and how we did the right thing at the time.
Absolutely. I'm so happy you bring up Syria, because to our point earlier about, you know, how the U.S. has related with Islam or political Islam in these varying ways, depending on what's convenient for ruling class interests in the U.S., there's no better example than Syria. Because, you know, the statement you've just made a few years ago would render you in many circles an Islamophobe. If you say, oh, you know, the U.S. is funding these moderate rebels and trying to topple the Assad government, you would be labeled an Islamophobe. That would be an anti-Muslim statement to make, which is just such a perverse rendering of what, you know, what, and this is why I'm motivated to add to our understanding of Islamophobia, the U.S.'s alliances with right-wing Islamist forces. Because without it, then you end up with these very sloppy interpretations of saying anything negative about Islamist forces such as, you know, al-Nusra, et cetera, in Syria, then renders you an Islamophobe. It's really, just a really cynical ploy, I think. You also mentioned, you know, sort of arrogance of American statecraft and empire. I don't think you can have imperialism without imperialist hubris or arrogance. I mean, it was Wolfowitz who in 2003 said, you know, they're going to welcome us in Iraq. They're going to welcome us as liberators. And then you have years and years of conflict that unfold and an insurgency that arises as a result of the U.S.'s just de-bathification in the country of Iraq. I think here we sit in the U.S. and we have to take really seriously this role of American hubris, this idea. And the same can be said in Afghanistan. People really thought it would be just easily winnable war. I think the same can be said of Syria. I think a lot of people thought that the Assad government could just be toppled with great ease by the U.S.'s sort of funding of its proxies in the region. So I think, you know, I think it's important that we take that seriously, too.
We absolutely have to. I don't know, Rachel, if you wanted to jump in here, but I think it's so critical to, and it brings me back to thinking about Indonesia, but also Libya, you know, thinking about the places where Muslim people live. And, you know, Libya was another one of these. And it was right before Syria. And of course, the NATO bombing of Libya happened right around the same time, right, as, you know, the anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Looking at the way Libya was treated in the media, it was a shorter run-up to the conflict, right, to the bombing, to the war. But there was this push for human rights, right? It was saying that, you know, Gaddafi was giving his soldiers, you know, Viagra or something and telling them to, you know, to rape Muslim women, which, you know, absolutely, first of all, was not true. It was just another one of these big propaganda pushes, similar to, you know, Saddam Hussein throwing out the babies in the incubators and in order to get people on board with a war, which is another, you know, thing that happens a lot. But, you know, I think we should talk about, you know, in Northern Africa, right? I mean, the Middle East, Northern Africa shares a lot of cultural history, and there are many differences as well. But the U.S. treats Islam as this thing that only comes from really the Middle East, except when it's convenient to them. But Rachel, I know you wanted to jump in. Go ahead.
I really appreciate, Nazia, the way that you're framing Islamophobia. And I think it's a really critical rethinking, because I think in the U.S. and especially kind of in the U.S. left, or kind of conversations that people have about Islamophobia, it can be very limiting and very limited to experiences people have here in the United States as a, you know, hyphenated American in many different ways. I definitely relate to this, just as, you know, thinking about racism against Asian Americans. I mean, people are not counting the anti-China sentiment that is fundamentally fueling the racism against Asian people in this country as part of the broader conversation that needs to happen about anti-Asian racism. I mean, it's not that complicated to jump in and understand that the role of empire has always been, when it comes to racism against Asian Americans, it has always been about the spies. It's always been about the kind of way that we otherize the enemy. I mean, that's what it's been for. And so it's an incomplete analysis, really, to say that, you know, stop Asian hate or just racism against Asian people. It's all about just kind of name calling or hate crimes or those kind of particularities in the U.S., because it's part of a broader conversation of empire. And I think Islamophobia is absolutely the same way. You can't talk about Islamophobia without talking about the U.S. invasion in Iraq, the U.S. invasion in Afghanistan, the U.S. war on terror, supposedly, the U.S. war in the Middle East. I mean, it's an incomplete narrative without seeing this bigger element, but also without then extending your analysis to actually talk about U.S. imperialism, not to just even mention it in passing for a domestic experience, but rather it's part and parcel and core to the experience of Islamophobia in the U.S. So I really appreciate that analysis without a doubt. And I feel very much so that that way of thinking is very critical today, because even when we talk about the war on terror, I mean, the U.S. has moved to some extent away from having the war on terror be its main focus. I mean, the main focus in terms of the U.S. war machine at this point is, of course, Russia, it's China, but the playbook isn't that different. It doesn't look that different. It's quite the same. If you really look closely, the U.S. is always using the same kind of narratives that connect racism abroad and racism at home. I mean, they are one in the same. So I do really appreciate your thinking on this.
Thank you. You know, and I think you're right that the style of war making remains the same, even if the focus shifts. So for instance, anytime you see American political figures or the mainstream media, who are basically the mouthpiece for American political leaders, talking about individuals who are evil figures, you know, Assad, Saddam Hussein is Hitler, Putin is a madman. Anytime you see this kind of individualization of these leaders, you better start listening really carefully, right? And you mentioned, Chris, earlier, you mentioned Libya, and that's a perfect example of it. I think the just brutal toppling of the Libyan state was sort of Hillary Clinton's love letter posthumously to Ronald Reagan, because that was a big part of his political career, was an anti-Gaddafi, anti-Libya posturing that then was actualized during the Obama years and led to the toppling of a very successful North African state. That's really important. And that was NATO. And so when we see NATO now in the Ukraine, we ought to ask ourselves a very similar question. So, yeah, I mean, I think your points, Rachel, are really important about, you know, American racism, about how the style of war making remains consistent, even as its focus shifts. And these are the lessons we ought to have learned from the so-called war on terror. But of course, unfortunately, in the American public consciousness, the quote unquote mistakes of the war on terror are just that. They're seen as mistakes. They're seen as blunders. They're seen as, well, Bush was such an idiot, or oops, we had faulty intelligence, or, you know, we really made a mistake there. I mean, that's kind of like the consensus. And that's a consensus that is reinforced, of course, for anyone who was in the anti-war, anti-imperialist movement in 2003. We know it's completely unfair to characterize it that way, that people always knew the WMD trope was a lie. People always knew that this invasion of Iraq was going to have horrible outcomes. So it's just a real big rewriting of history to render it some kind of blunder.
Yeah, especially a blunder that people weren't pushing back against as they were happening. I mean, the incubator babies thing, I remember people actively pushing back against this narrative as it was going on. And I mean, the fact that one of the first anti-war protests happened not too long right after 9/11, and the entire mainstream media was like, this is so profoundly disrespectful for you to protest. And anti-war activists said, we're going to do it because it's, you know, 9/11 is absolutely a tragedy. That is true. But the reality is that this is going to be, and we see the future. We see what's going to happen here. And the U.S. is going to wreak absolute chaos on Iraq and the Middle East and a part of the world that is going to be devastated by this. So we need to be very conscious and aware. And I do agree with you. The framing itself kind of really keeps us out of that narrative. It keeps us away from the fact that people were actively resisting and rejecting these ideas outright. And it wasn't 10 years later that we found out the intelligence itself was faulty. People immediately felt that there was something wrong here. But nonetheless, I mean, one of the other things I had wanted to say and bring in here about the kind of individual narrative, I really appreciate bringing that forward, because I think the other part of it too is every time we talk about individual narrative, individual leaders, we are missing out on the greater context of what people in those countries even think about those leaders. I mean, there's so much to be said about the Ba'athist Party and Saddam Hussein and people's actual public opinions about the government that the U.S. was not in, like people in the U.S. were not made aware of. It's just this person is profoundly evil and this is it. And of course, there's always issues and there's always things wrong with leaders and wrong with people in different movements in different countries. But that's not necessarily here nor there. I mean, the same thing goes for Assad. Like 80% of the people in Syria voted for and supported the Assad government. That's a lot of people. That is a mass popular support of a politician. It's not about whether or not that politician is the most perfect politician to have ever existed. I mean, Putin as well. It's a very complicated relationship people have with him and how he got into power in the first place. I mean, people really had respected in Russia that Putin was a figure that stood up to the U.S. and to the West and had Russian nationalism. That was very appealing to people in Russia. So I just think that there needs to be a greater fleshing out as well, outside of just the individual, but a greater fleshing out of the kind of surrounding reality of what people thought. I mean, Gaddafi, absolutely the same. I mean, Gaddafi, for a lot of people, was a Pan-African leader. I mean, that's what he did. I mean, Libya was a place where women had the most education in all of North Africa. I mean, there is so much too in terms of the actual government of Gaddafi that profoundly benefited the people of Libya And yet the narrative around what people, not just one or two or three individual people that CNN calls because they're a correspondent that they know or somehow is tied to one of these movements that's pro-West. But the reality is that the public opinion of these figures is a lot more complicated and nuanced. And so I really think it's an important thing to get into.
Yeah, I mean, nuance is not allowed here. We don't do nuance. That was made clear. That was made explicit by Bush in his address to the nation after September 11th. He says, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. And I think that was a formal policy position. It wasn't just rhetoric in his speech. You know, returning to the question of Islamophobia, the early days of the war on terror, the immediate aftermath of September 11th, what both Glenn Beck and Hillary Clinton have called the spirit of 9/12, was a precise kind of policing of this binary. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists. So suddenly, speaking out against Israeli apartheid renders you a terrorist, or God forbid, making a donation to like a Palestinian human rights organization can literally, if you're Muslim in the U.S. after 9/11, can get you locked up for decades. There was no role for this kind of nuance that you're talking about. And that was on a formal policy level. You were either with us or with the terrorists. I mean, for those of your listeners who are too young to remember, you know, the immediate aftermath of September 11th, it was a remarkably repressive time. You had students being expelled from school for wearing anti-war t-shirts. You had school teachers facing disciplinary action for showing their students maps of the world and explaining the histories of the politics of various regions that added nuance. I mean, nuance was a crime because when you add nuance to the conversation, the entire logics of the war on terror just collapse, as do America's ambitions against China. I mean, one of the things that's really striking to me right now in the classroom is students are arriving in my classes from high school having been fed a remarkable amount of anti-China rhetoric. And these are students who can't, again, who can't tell you why the US invaded Iraq in 2003, who can't tell you who Julian Assange was, who can't tell you the first thing about the war on terror or American militarism, but have been fed this logic about China as a huge human rights violator or China as a major polluter. Of course, you know, the US military is the biggest polluter on planet Earth. But again, there's no room for that conversation. So I think your point about nuance is really, really well taken here.
I think as we get into our last few minutes, I mean, first, I want to say, you know, I was a high school senior when 9/11 happened, and I, you know, certainly remember a lot of things shifting. I mean, really immediately, literally the next day or two. I want to ask about another lesson that I think we have to learn. And you have spoken about this, you know, in various forums. And it is that we also can't take away, or we can't assume that the things that happened post 9/11, the Patriot Act, the surveillance were new, that it was all of a sudden this, you know, proto-fascist, you know, Bush government that came in and put these things into place, that these were actually things that were happening. So, yes, Muslims were being surveilled. Mosques in New York City and across the country were being surveilled by the NYPD, by the local police, by the FBI. But at the same time, you know, that is something that has happened to religious and national groups, you know, across, you know, U.S. history. You've brought up in other pieces, you know, Native American groups. Certainly communists have dealt with this, Jewish groups, as well as certainly Black liberation groups have dealt with this in the past. And so I think if there's, you know, another lesson that we have to come out of this conversation with, it's that the U.S. was not suddenly transformed on 9/11 in the sense that it was now repressive towards Muslims, towards other people, but it was a continuation and an excuse, in fact, to heighten that surveillance and that oppression overall.
For sure. I mean, look, what happened to local police departments after September 11th was they took on increasingly like counterterrorism policing roles. And that was not this like brand new thing. I mean, like the NYPD has long been involved in surveillance of, you know, communities of color, political communities, and has been since then. It was after September 11th that the NYPD partnered with the CIA to develop its demographics unit, which was basically a Muslim surveillance unit. And by Muslim surveillance, I mean, you know, Arab coffee shops and bookstores, not just like political organizations or mosques, but mosques were absolutely formally labeled terrorist designations by the NYPD. So that's really important. But, you know, I think what you're pointing to, the ways in which 9/11 and the war on terror that followed were an extension of some of the key features of American political life is really important. I mean, one of the things that often falls out of the conversation is the economic reforms that happened in the wake of 9/11. So right after 9/11, when the American public is terrified, and not just terrified, but made to be terrified of a second terrorist attack, another terrorist attack. You know, it could be your town next. It could be your flight next. Was the reshuffling of the American economic system. The tax code was rewritten to benefit the ultra wealthy in the US. That airline executives were given huge bailouts from the Bush administration, and not bailouts that helped the ordinary employees of the airline industry, but its highest paid executives. That offshore drilling was expanded. That basically 9/11 allowed the American public to be so distracted. And of course, Islamophobia was one of those key distractions, the fear of the Muslim threat, to allow further plunder of the working class by those at the very top. And I think that's something that often falls out of the conversation when we just focus on narrowly on like the 9/11 as sort of a political event.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think so much needs to be drawn together about this. I mean, the motives of empire are the motives of capitalism. I mean, you can't have capitalism without this idea of this necessary expansion, which is where so much of this comes out of to begin with. I mean, it's really a question, an economic question in so many ways around what the U.S. ruling class is interested in. I mean, where are the resources? Where are they? What are they going after? Why are we expanding? I mean, those are our fundamental questions really about the nature of the capitalist system. And so I think you're very right in bringing that forward. And I think that's a great place that we are going to have to leave it. There is so much more we could talk about here, but we really appreciate your expertise and all of the incredible information you've shared with us today. We were joined by Dr. Nazia Kazi, author of Islamophobia, Race, and Global Politics, an associate professor of anthropology at Stockton University in New Jersey. Thanks for joining the show, Dr. Nazia.
Thanks for having me here.
Well, either way, we're going to have to leave it right there. But before we go, if you like what you heard today and want to support independent journalism, go to patreon.com/covertactionmagazine. That's patreon.com/covertactionmagazine. Become a patron to get early access to content, but really become a patron to support independent journalism and support the show that you heard today. We really appreciate all of the support we get from our patrons. You've been listening to Covert Action Bulletin. I'm Rachel Hu.
And I'm Chris Garaffa. Covert Action is the official show of Covert Action Magazine and is brought to you by way of WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio in New York. If you've missed any of our episodes, you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts by searching for Covert Action Bulletin or listen on your station's archives.
What you just heard was a program from Covert Action Bulletin titled Islamophobia and Imperialism, 20 years after the invasion of Iraq. It was an interview with Dr. Nazia Kazi, author of Islamophobia, Race, and Global Politics, and Associate Professor of Anthropology at Stockton University in New Jersey. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, Executive Producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
22 y el 23 de septiembre estamos en la Rote Fabrik.
Am 22. und 23. September in der Roten Fabrik.
Come to the Rote Fabrik, 22nd and 23rd of September.
Ich bin Fabio, ich bin Radio Lora, mega cool.
40 anni Radio Lora, lora.ch.
We are celebrating 40 years, 40 years of amazing people and amazing ideas.
14 na taon, Radio Lora, lora.ch.
Seit 40 Jahren, Radio Lora, lora.ch.
40 Jahre, Radio Lora, lora.ch.
40 Jahre widerständig in 40 Sprachen, beinahe. Als erstes werbefreies Radio, gefolgt von 40 weiteren. Das kommt noch. Komm auch!
Irailaren 22-23an, Rote Fabriken ikusiko gara.
Il 22 e 23 di settembre, Fabrica Rossa in Zurigo.
Wann ist das? Am 22. und 23. September in der Roten Fabrik